communities, it's just really beneficial to bounce ideas off of each other.
So she says it's a great opportunity to connect and collaborate. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
KBOO's legendary news poet Dan Raphael keeps aware to not repeat his parents' prejudices.
Knowing that a woman of color is president is enough of a stretch for the semi-prejudicial discomfort of enough Americans, the Democrats knew that Kamala's VP couldn't be another woman, a gay man, or a Jew. I know the bigotry I grew up in that I must keep resisting, as most of us get little twinges of fear and judgment from some perceived difference, be it skin color, behavior, language, or past experience. While the president doesn't have great power, and Trump wouldn't be able to do much of what he and Project 2025 offer, it is beyond crucial to make absolutely certain he's not back in the White House, as his Supreme Court appointments have already done irreparable damage to our democracy. Maybe when Trump loses the election, his gun-toting maggots won't have to revolt. The Supreme Court will overturn the will of the people. Then what will we do? And who will we be, finally facing a serious enough threat to unite us in spite of our media-stoked prejudices and fears? For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, August 7th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael, Grant Button, and Reed Johnson. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Eric Tagadoff, Brian Bull, Alex Gonzalez, Mike Moen, and Kathleen Shannon. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eliza Yurkov.
And I'm Grant Button. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm here with Kimberly Cortez, the Snowden reporting intern at Street Roots, to talk about her latest story. It's called What's Affordable Rent to the City of Portland? Nearly 30% of affordable rents within $6 of fair market rate under inclusionary housing. Welcome, Kimberly.
Hi, Althea. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. So your new story dives into the Inclusionary Housing Program, which was created in 2017 by the Portland Housing Bureau. You find some troubling realities associated with the affordable housing that the program seeks to provide. Before we get into the analysis and what you found, let's start with a baseline. What is the Inclusionary Housing Program? What did it set out to do?
Yeah, so the Inclusionary Housing Program was created in 2017, when the City of Portland declared a housing crisis. And so, you know, the program was created to sort of address Portland's housing affordability crisis. After 7 years of its inception, what we found was that the program's goal of helping create 23,000 units to serve low and moderate income households, you know, those parameters skew away from low income Portlanders, specifically those that work minimum wage or just above minimum wage.
Well, there's some important terms to define in this story, like the mechanics of actually how the program works. And one of those is median family income, which is partly what these eventual rent rates are based on. How is median family income defined?
Yeah, so Portland uses the federally determined median family income, which is from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD. And basically, how they calculate the median family income, or MFI, is they take all the incomes in a given metropolitan area, including those with higher incomes, and they calculate sort of like an average of, you know, what people are paying in maximum rent and what qualifies, what makes someone's income eligible for affordable housing programs. But what that results in is that, you know, for example, a single person making 60% of Portland's median family income, what the inclusionary housing program considers, you know, affordable, someone that is struggling to pay for affordable housing, that yearly salary is about $49,000, which, you know, is quite a lot of money, but may not reflect those that are, you know, facing the most difficulties in trying to get affordable housing. And so it can be kind of complicated. It's a complicated system to use. But the important thing to understand here is that by using this median family income threshold, you know, certain people are left out, particularly those that may have extremely low income or low income. What we found was that, you know, these thresholds are about 149% or 199% of a full-time minimum wage worker in Portland. And that's assuming, you know, they don't take any days off, you know, they work 52 weeks, which might also not be accurate to, you know, the struggles of day-to-day life. You know, emergencies happen. So, you know, the question here is, who is this program really for if those affordability standards are set quite high?
To summarize, the inclusionary housing program incentivizes developers to set aside some amount of their units to be more affordable under this standard based on median family income. But what you found is that median family income is quite a bit higher than what folks are may actually be experiencing, especially if they're working minimum wage or they have much lower income. So then on to your analysis. Street Roots analysis revealed that 30% of those affordable units that are created under this program through the city of Portland can be rented within mere dollars of what would be called fair market rate. What is the significance of that?
PHB has a sort of like median family income chart, and that sort of gives a guideline as to what 60% or 80% median family income looks like for like a studio, a one bedroom, a two bedroom. And so what we did was we compared those prices that are under the inclusionary housing program to, you know, what would be considered like just a typical average market rate, you know, studio, one bedroom or two bedroom. And what we found was that, you know, it was either just below or just above, actually, that the inclusionary housing units, like the 80% median family income studio, was actually $2 above the market rent for a Portland studio apartment. So, you know, the important thing here is that this is supposed to be affordable. It's supposed to be less than the market rent, because, you know, the market rent is sort of a marker of like people that do make that average medium income. But, you know, if the inclusionary housing unit is not that far off the market rent, you know, what is the goal of the program then?
What are some of the implications here for developers?
The interesting thing about the inclusionary housing program, unlike other housing programs, is that it's actually required for any development with 20 or more units. But the thing is that there's a bunch of financial incentives that come with that. So, you know, they are required to build these affordable units, but if the median family income chart that PHB provides is essentially in line with market rent, what that means is that in practice, a developer could make, you know, a building in the Central City Plan District, for example, and they could technically make inclusionary housing units, but because they're almost the same as market rent, they're not really renting any affordable units, but they would still qualify for property taxes, construction excise tax exemptions, wage system development charges, and so they're pocketing that money.
I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier, right? The inclusionary housing program sets out to serve low-income renters, but your analysis shows that isn't panning out, and I want to be explicit about it. Who is getting left out and why?
Yeah, I talked to an advocate at the National Low-Income Housing Coalition, and what they said was that this program is at risk for underserving larger families. And that is also something that is flagged in the city auditor's report of this program. You know, people with more than a single person household can struggle finding affordable housing, what PHB considers family size apartments. Citywide, there are no affordable housing options for a three-person household with extremely low income or low income. And data suggests that families may struggle the most in finding affordable housing. And not to mention that MFI-based race leave out a whole host of other people. For example, low-income households with fixed incomes, so people on Social Security or supplemental security income, those income supports don't necessarily grow with inflation. And so people that receive those supports may face greater challenges affording rent. And so, you know, when we ask who is this program leaving out, it could leave out a considerable amount of people, especially people with lower incomes, which is sort of ironic because that's a stated goal on the inclusionary housing website, is to serve low and moderate income households. So while it may be serving more moderate income households, I don't think the same could be said for low income households.
Well, in looking at this, what sort of metric could be used instead of median family income?
Yeah, something that that advocate told me at the National Low Income Housing Coalition is that, you know, there could be a focus less on a median family income and more on tenants' actual incomes. Having a program that specifically looks at people on the lower end of that median family income could be especially useful. But at this moment in time, I'm not quite sure if the city is considering using a different threshold for affordability. When I asked them if they were, they said, you know, we're keeping track of, you know, those incomes that are 0 to 30%. But they admitted and acknowledged that the inclusionary housing program might not be best fit to help those people, despite its goal saying it is helping those people.
One other minor point I wanted to ask you about was this part where the rents for those units are pegged to that percentage of Portland's median family income for 99 years. What is that? How does that timeline play in?
Yeah, so part of, you know, this sort of back and forth with like trying to balance like incentivizing developers and lowering rent prices, one of the, I guess, stipulations in the program is that while developers and ideally get, you know, these incentives, they have to keep those units affordable. It's not like they get to put those at market rate, although our analysis kind of says otherwise, but they have a 99-year requirement for you know, those inclusionary housing units to meet those 60% and 80% MFI affordability thresholds. But it's important to note that city auditors pointed this out as a potential compliance risk as buildings take on new owners and staff. It may be hard to keep track of if, you know, property managers are actually keeping those units to the correct MFI percentage. And it's also important to note that the Portland Housing Bureau right now is 2 years behind on reviewing and testing compliance data reported by property managers. So it's their job to oversee if these property managers are properly requiring IH units to meet that MFI percentage for 9 years. But if they're behind on units that already exist, it kind of puts into question if they have either the proper resources or the right sort of compliance to actually see if those units will be regulated at those MFI percentages for 99 years.
And right, it's going to stay at that percentage of it for 99 years. It's not going to be pegged to a certain amount, right?
Yeah, but the MFI can grow. So it's not necessarily fixed, which is another problem that can happen with these MFI-based rates, is that if an area starts to get richer, the MFI goes up. So while it's regulated at that percentage, the MFI does potentially grow, making it potentially less accessible for people that really need affordable housing.
All in all, what does this mean for low-income renters and the efforts to stem the affordable housing crisis?
I think something that I took away from this investigation was that there needs to be a bigger conversation about what affordability thresholds we're using and what the average Portlander that is struggling to find affordable housing, what kind of incomes those people are making, what kind of threshold can we use that can encapsulate, you know, the people that are struggling the most, that are the most housing cost burdened. And I'm not quite sure what that threshold means, and I'm aware that, you know, it's hard to create and assess a tool that can, you know, encapsulate everybody. But if the program is designed to help low-income renters, it should do a better job in making sure that it meets that demographic, or it should change its goals to, you know, more moderate-income households. I think that as the city moves towards a more punitive measure for people that are homeless, it should be doing a better job in making sure that it's properly assessing and supporting its housing programs to actually help those people get out of their situation and improve their housing status if it's going to continue to punish those people.
Well, if our listeners are interested in reading your work for themselves, what's the best way for them to do that?
You can read the story in this week's Street Roots paper, get the paper at your local Street Roots vendor, or you can read it online later this week.
Thank you, Kimberly, for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you.
That was Kimberly Cortez, the Snowden reporting intern at Street Roots, talking with me about her story from this week's paper. It's called What's Affordable to the City of Portland? Nearly 30% of affordable rents within $6 of fair market rate under inclusionary housing. More information is online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Reed Johnson. Tesla shareholders recently voted overwhelmingly to re-ratify a $48 billion stock option package that the company's board of directors had granted CEO Elon Musk in 2018. The Delaware Court of Chancery had rescinded the deal 5 months earlier. Now Musk can exercise nearly 304 million options to purchase Tesla shares. William Lozonik is a retired professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell and one of the authors of a recent article on Musk's stock option package and its implications for the transition to electric vehicles. He spoke with KABU contributor David Rosenberg. Here is part one of their conversation.
So Elon Musk and his compensation package, $48 billion in stock options, is that unusual or unprecedented? Does that go way beyond what even most CEOs get?
Yeah, so it's totally unprecedented. But the article that I wrote with Matt Hopkins, it's on the website of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, points out that this is not a compensation package. It really looks like a compensation package because executives get stock options as compensation. But it actually, he's had three packages, one in 2009, one in 2012, and one in 2018, which were designed to give him control over more shares of Tesla. Now, as a result of that, he also...
Did he orchestrate that, or was that...
He orchestrated that. He was the chairman of the company, so he was basically employing himself. In the United States, there's obviously controversy about this, but it's quite typical for the CEO and the chairman to be the same person, which basically means the board of directors is supposed to oversee the employee, the CEO, is actually being led by the employee who is the CEO as a chairman. And of course, it's well known that the CEO handpicks the people on the board unless they're challenged. And that's really what the whole thing is about, is that particularly once Tesla went public in 2010, partly to raise some money, partly because they were paying a lot of their employees in stock options, which were compensation, where they would exercise the options, then sell the shares, put the money in their bank accounts. This was a little different for, quite different for Musk. Musk came in basically in 2004, about 6 or 8 months after the company was founded, with money that he had got from the sale of PayPal. He subsequently put in $315 million of his own money in an early stage, so he got founder shares, a certain number of shares for that. And now the company was trying to develop a product. They developed the Roadster. And then the second product was the S, which came out in 2012. The Roadster came out before the IPO in 2010. And Tesla was not profitable, but had a plan to produce a series of cars that would become more affordable to the public, both because they would get more economies of scale over time, and because they would actually produce cars that were somewhat less high end, although all of them are quite high end in terms of software and their quality. And ultimately, they after 2018, when he got the last stock option package, the one that's being debated, that was rescinded by the Delaware court early in 2024, that is then reapproved on June 13th by the Tesla board, and depending how you calculate it, but it's really about $44 billion before taxes, about $30 billion after taxes, that got reapproved. Now, at that point, they knew at Tesla that within a few years they'd be profitable, although there was a lot of short sellers, a lot of people who were bidding down the price of their stock. That didn't really matter so much to Tesla per se, because it wasn't raising money really from the stock market. It was raising money from getting money from the sale of its cars by this point. But what Musk knew and the board knew is that once it became profitable, the hedge funds would not just be short sellers. They would be coming in to try to grab control of the company. And he was vulnerable. He could be ousted. And so
he needed voting power.
He needed voting power. And that's what it was all about. And we go through it in the article, different points in time, that basically he had well over 20% of the voting power when they gave him that options package in 2018. When that he didn't automatically get those stock options. They had to meet performance criteria, mostly related to production goals, which is actually not usual in pay packages. It's pay packages, the stock price goes up, the executives get their 20 million, 30 million, 40 million, or whatever. It can be 200 million, but not 44 billion. Okay. The quantity of shares that were there were to get his control up toward around 30%. Now, he had to wait till those vested. I think it was in 2021 or 2022. And by that point, however, he made a rash move, which everybody knows about. He bought Twitter. And when he bought Twitter, without those options in the 2018 grant, or two earlier ones where he got more shares, but this was the big one. Without those options, once he had to sell shares, about $34 billion of his Tesla shares to buy Twitter, he was down to about 13% of voting power. And there he would be vulnerable to a hedge fund activist coming in, lining up institutional investors, getting Glass Lewis and ISS, the proxy advisory services, to recommend against him, which actually they did, at least in terms of this stock options package, the second time around. Now, they do have, it's one vote, one share, but there is a, in their part of their constitution, you might say, there is that you need a 67% of the votes to have a major change, like getting rid of the CEO. But that still meant that he was not totally secure unless, let's say, over 25%, totally secure with 33% or 34% of the votes. But now the problem was, once the judge rescinded this 2018 package, he was not up over around 20%, but because he had sold those Twitter shares, he was down around 13%. So that's why it was so important for him to get it back. Now, obviously, the corollary of that is that they're worth a hell of a lot of money, way more money than they would have given him as just pay.
What does all this mean in terms of energy transition?
Well, what it means is that, but people have to, that this isn't just how much pay he's getting or whether it's fair to the shareholders or not fair to the shareholders. I mean, he could make the argument that the value of Tesla went up so much, even that 44 billion, you know, was a bargain for shareholders. If he could argue that, you know, he alone did it, you know, he had a big role in it. He didn't do it all himself. He hired all kinds of other people to do it, but credit where credit is due. He started a company, or he came in right at the beginning, invested in a company that no one had ever done this, had done, really created a new car company since, you know, for ages, decades. I mean, DeLorean tried to do it back in the late 70s, early 80s and failed.
That's probably a collector's item. Huh?
Yeah. Was busted for cocaine smuggling, trying to fund the company. But in any case, or at least it was accused of that. In any case, it was done. And this is not just another internal combustion engine car company. This is a pioneer company in producing pure electric vehicles or battery electric vehicles. They invested in charging stations, and they had collaborations with the Japanese and with the Chinese on batteries. And they put it all together. And there's no doubt that Tesla is the pioneer in having a mass-produced electric vehicle, all-electric vehicle, that pushed everybody else who was in position to do this to move faster, including BYD in China, which is really up there with Tesla. But that is in part.
So in a way, Musk is a great innovator.
And SpaceX has been a success. A lot of government funding, but they have Starlink, and they're launching these rockets, reusable rockets.
But is he overreaching?
But here's the point that we make in the article is that really it's about control. It's not about compensation. And so the question, let's say the public policy question, or the question we should be concerned about, I'm not concerned about it from a shareholder point of view, that we could be concerned about having this pioneering electric vehicle company in the context of the EV transition, where General Motors is really spending money on stock buybacks, shooting itself in the foot in terms of the transition, just making its profits on the big, you know, gas guzzlers. Same with Ford, really not making that transition. So this is the big hope of the U.S. and the big player in the global economy. And how is he going to use that control? And he's shown himself more and more in terms of to be quite impetuous, be quite doing things that he thinks that he should do, but may not be good for everybody else. I mean, and here is a guy, you know, who went into Tesla saying the world needs green energy, you know, and we need to make that transition. Now he's just put in not only say that he would vote for Trump, which means you're voting anti-EV transition. I mean, Trump's been quite clear about that, but that he'll give his campaign through a super PAC $45 million a month, $180 million over the next 4 months, you know, to try to get him elected.
That was part one of retired University of Massachusetts economic professor William Lozonik speaking with KABU contributor David Rosenberg. They discussed Elon Musk's stock option package at Tesla and its implications for the transition to electric vehicles. Tune into KABU tomorrow at 5:45 to hear part two of this interview. For KABU News in Depth, I'm Reed Johnson.
Thanks for listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM in the Portland metro area and all over the world at KBOO.fm.
The 2024 election is coming, and we at KBOO want to make sure your voice is heard. Take KBOO's election agenda.